Welcome to Beauty as a Birthright, a podcast where we decode the evolving concept of beauty from a multidimensional lens. In this space, we embark on a journey with engaging guests from all walks of life to figure out if beauty is a birthright, then what's our legacy? So let's get started. Angda Seonapan is an artist, healing practitioner, and founder of Batsy. Her life's work is guided by her Laotian last name, which means the light of the full moon. She explores ways of illuminating our fears and bridging the duality of living and dying through her platform, Batsy. Additionally, she's been immersed in the mystical healing arts for over 15 years and is currently enrolled in the New York Zen Center's Contemplative Care Program. Welcome.
Hello.
Welcome, welcome. Oh my God, I love that your last name is the light of the full moon because we are in the full moon today.
It's true. Today's a full moon.
Oh my God, I'm so excited to chat with you and just like learn more about your work because it's been growing and I feel like you're reaching out to different communities. And so we always start these episodes asking our guests, what's the most beautiful thing about you today?
That's a nice question. I think a tenderness feels really beautiful right now.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I love that. How does that show up for you?
If I could shape it, it feels soft and gentle, and I think just a little comforting.
So this episode is going to come out much later, but we're recording it in July, which is the month of the sheep in the Chinese zodiac. Mm. And the sheep is all about tenderness and like softness and sensitivity. And it's the most yin feminine animal in all of the Chinese zodiac. And it represents the maternal archetype. And so I think at least for Korean culture, like people don't see the sheep as this like powerful animal. Like sometimes they go out of their way to have babies outside of the year of the sheep because the idea that sheeps are followers and they can't think for themselves, they're not independent. But this month I've been really reflecting on like what can the sheep teach us? And it's like so much about tenderness, like the soft life, like, and how, yes, you might not have these desires to be like a CEO, but they're always thinking about like, how do we take care of ourselves and how do we take care of our collective?
Love that. That's so fitting. And I wonder if there's a lot of overlap that you see from Western astrology.
Totally. Cause we're in Cancer season.
Just remember that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Yeah. So Mangda, you know, I think Tamsin has known you before having you on our podcast, and I'm so excited to get to know you more. First, I want to hear more about your background culturally, ethnically, and if you can share that with our audience.
Sure. My dad is from Laos and huge Laotian family in Texas and West Coast and around the world. And my mother, she is mixed European descent, Irish, I think she has some French, German, and very disconnected from that side. I actually never really met anyone in her family growing up, I think until her mother was passing away. So,
interesting. Mm-hmm. How did your parents meet?
So my father was a refugee and the church that helped sponsor my family was in Southern Idaho. And one of his brothers traveled to Massachusetts. So he followed his brother eventually and he met my mother in Massachusetts because I think my uncle was dating one of her friends or something. So there was actually a big Laotian and refugee community in this area in Massachusetts called Lowell. And so that's how they met out there. And then, yeah, and then here I am.
Mm-hmm. So growing up as a multiracial, multicultural child, what was your understanding of beauty then? And then how has it evolved now as an adult?
I think it's been a complicated blessing. I think that a lot of people that are multicultural, multiracial can definitely relate to that. It's confusing. I think growing up as a little girl, we moved away from Massachusetts, and you know, there's just is a really hard area that we're in. So my mother wanted to go somewhere safer. We went to just more rural areas and tiny towns. And so it's predominantly white. So I already naturally looked different. And I think as a child, like I didn't really feel like there was natural connections being made. Like I think there was natural separation, which is really interesting for children to even understand that at such a young age. So I naturally felt really different. And I think as I got older, as I was like a teenager, I was unconsciously trying to adapt. So my hair is really curly and it's thick and it's dark and, you know, straightening it out all the time, like just trying to look more like my peers. And I think it was just a sense of trying to fit in. And I also feel like I've had a complicated relationship with beauty a little bit. My mother was just so Virgoed out, like loved beauty, like loved makeup, loved her hair, doing all of that. And at the same time had a lot of difficulty with skin. She had a crooked eye for a long time, and that really affected her self-worth, her appearance, and she couldn't afford to fix it until later in her adulthood. So for me, the complication was I was always reminded, well, your skin's great, you know, you should be so lucky. There's a lot of these, I think, unconscious messages all the time about where I'm not struggling or where I'm still beautiful, but yet there's still this other sense of confusion, you know? And I think too, I don't know how often we're like our parents, but I was literally nothing like my mother. I think everything I've done in my life is rebel. She really loved like the traditional feminine, lots of hair, lots of makeup, you know, dressing a specific way. And I think as I just grew older, I found beauty in what's not so traditional. You know, I found beauty in things that you couldn't buy. I found beauty in, you know, the way people laughed, the way people communicated in essence. I loved strangeness, things that made people seem kind of peculiar. I found that so beautiful. And I think that really shaped beauty for me, is in a very non-traditional way and what we typically see as beautiful.
Right.
How did you get to that place? Like, you know, because I'm like listening to your story, it's like I can imagine as a child moving around a lot in these small rural places where you're not seeing people that look like you. And I'm imagining, you know, sometimes kids are cruel, right? Yeah. And then with this mom who is this a hyper feminine, you know, she loves all like the girly stuff. And then you going completely opposite. It doesn't sound like you were rebelling against her, but just like finding your own space in this beauty where it looks very different for you.
Totally. And I think there's also gender too that was pushed. I remember when I was really young, my mom would always be like, you need to dress more girly. You need to be more girly. And I think like just inherently, I think because I was so free as a child, and I didn't grow up watching TV. I didn't grow up watching a lot of movies. So I didn't really have a lot of, I think, just messaging, advertisements, you know, standard media to really influence how I thought. Because I was outside all the time as a little kid. And that I'm so grateful for in a lot of ways, because for me, it just came so intuitive, and I found it. Like I saw it in other people. I wasn't told what I should be looking for that's beautiful all the time.
Mm-hmm. I do think though, you know, you mentioned that you found really unique features in individuals to be very beautiful. And even though your mom, her lifestyle, the things that she was interested in was very mainstream at the time and kind of adhering to those standards of what's feminine, what's beautiful, but she did have that unique feature with the eye that you shared with us. Mm-hmm. So I can see how that can be picked out too, of I see my mom, I feel she's beautiful, she has something unique. Looking at other people, wow, what makes them unique? That's really beautiful too. I kind of hear that when you were sharing this with us.
Oh, it's such a beautiful connection. I never thought about that so much. Because I had a very non-traditional family. I mean, everything that they did was pretty outside of tradition, racially, age, everything. Yeah, I think even their occupations, what they like to do, like they're just like a little rock and roll. And I think like, and I was like a wild free child. But yeah, and I do, I think too, because in those rural towns, a lot of people look the same, you wear the same thing as everyone else. And I think like they kind of saw it as really, you know, I didn't find it visually stimulating. So when there were people that just kind of looked different or there's something different about them, I was like, ooh, that's interesting. You know, like I'm intrigued.
Yeah, I love this. So your mom was disconnected from her family. Growing up, did your dad bring a lot of Laotian culture and traditions?
Yeah, it was always in our house so much so that I didn't even realize it. Just what we ate, how he was, what we did, because we were displaced from family. We were so far away from his side of the family. Like whenever mm-hmm. I would see them, that was, I don't know how to even describe it. It just, and I think it's just home, you know, like home in a sense with people, it's blood, it's family, it's love. But in our home, it was there, you know, traditional sticky rice and the foods that we ate, the things that we said, but there's a lot of him having to strip that away, you know, to survive. Right. So that's unfortunate. I think there's something about that that I feel so driven to hold on to in my life.
This is a good segue to talk more about what you do for work as a death doula.
Okay.
I'm getting chills.
Oh, okay. Let's warm it up.
I am like, oh, this is going to be so juicy and so good. This is exactly what I need. Because I've been grieving for the last 2 months. And it just came out of nowhere over a death that I experienced. I had lost like almost 10 years ago, right? So it's like, this year, I mean, obviously, because it's tiger year, so we're going to do this, right? And it just came out of nowhere. And I'm coming out of it. But this grieving process was so vastly different than the other times that I've grieved about this person or anybody else. And so, you know, you just talked about how your dad had to leave, you know, even though he's bringing a lot of culture into the house, there's a lot of his stories and identity in his culture that he probably had to strip away. And so that I think is this other idea of grieving the life that you once knew and the life that you may not be living yet for whatever reason, you know? So first, what is a death doula? And then how, I have so many follow-up questions, but I'm going to start with what is a death doula and how did you come about, like, how did you come to this work?
Yeah. So very generally, a death doula is a non-medical support for someone at the end of life or pre-death, pre-dying or after death, after dying. So it's essentially a person that is facilitating and filling in spaces that needs to be when it comes to the end of life process. So every death doula can be different. You know, most death doulas really have their specific areas of expertise or interest. So yeah, it can look like a broad range of different ways in which that they can assist you, or can be one very specific way.
So what does the experience of working with you, what would that look like for someone?
Yeah, so I primarily work a lot with people pre-dying. I work a lot with educating. I work a lot in grief work. I work a lot in supporting people that have lost someone or is losing someone. I also have worked with people that are the family members of the dying. That's usually who I'm working with because of the pandemic, because it's hard to be in hospice. It's been hard to be with those individuals in person. So that's why a lot of my work is focused on this area.
And do you work with people who are dying themselves?
Currently, I haven't been. Again, because of the pandemic, but I have worked with these individuals before the pandemic, and yeah, it's various stages of end of life.
So, you know, Magda, in the US, death is so feared, and I really don't love the culture around that aspect of it. And then in Western allopathic biomedicine, it's this very sterile process. And a lot of times people are dying alone because they can be susceptible to something, or they have something, and they're kind of just like visited with gloves and, you know, just like very, it's very, very sterile. So I, you know, part of your journey that I realized we didn't mention already on this podcast yet, but you experienced your mother's own death, and that was a big influence of what brought you to your field now as a death doula. So going through that process, did you find that the narrative moved away from fear and being so sterile? And if so, how did that inform you of your sense of beauty, life's different beauties?
Yeah, my mother, I helped her at the end of her life, and this is pre-pandemic, and it was at a home setting, so she didn't want to die in a hospital, and that was her right, and we're at the home, and there was so many challenges to it, and I would say because of that time, I would say death, loss, and grief really wasn't talked about, and after she had died, death, loss, and grief wasn't really talked about. And it was really still seen as taboo, you know, something that we avoided. And that's why I created Bossy, is I really wanted to create a space in which that it was talked about. There is communication, there is conversation, there is connection, there is community, and there's education. There's ways in which that we can really understand the end of life. So it's for ourselves, for our loved ones, in order to really show up for them. I think that's the, you know, it's a really difficult component when you're working or being with someone at the end of their life, and there's so much fear, and the fear is really the thing that is driving us, where it's hard to access the love or the support or the care, where it's just too scary. And so I ask this all the time with people that take my groups, or, you know, the workshops that I'm doing, or the people I work with, how has the pandemic affected you? Have you been more open to discussing these topics because it's been so shielded and censored and even denied to that extent? Or has it induced even more fear in you because we are seeing it in such mass loss, you know, in such macro ways? And it's filling our headlines every day to the point where it's almost desensitizing us in some ways, you know? You know, bless the institutions, but that really has been one of the most significant changes historically in our Western world when it comes to end of life care, is death was happening at the home, we're tending to our dying. And then once we started getting all these third party institutional spaces, and again, grateful for them for many ways, that really disempowered us, and we begin to see this, the end of life, as to be feared, you know, even to the extent in which that death becomes a failure. And I think that's what's really difficult and gets so complicated when we are with loved ones. And it's the ethics that comes up is, you know, at one point, does it not become a failure? Is it a failure to die? And they have their ways in which to be with the dying and to tend to us with medicine, and that's their arena. And I think that's a major component of why death doulas exist. Death doulas are really here to fill in those spaces. There's not enough time to tend to people. There's not enough time to really bring that emotional and spiritual component that a lot of people need when they're navigating the end of life.
Amanda, this makes me so grateful for Chinese medicine, because when I entered the doctoral program, our first half, we talked about death and dying and how it's so vastly different between our death and dying training as medical professionals, because we may not see, well, no, I'm going to back up. Because in allopathic medicine, they're trained to save people's lives. So mm-hmm. doctors aren't, like you said, aren't, when their patient dies, that's a failure on their part. And so, so much of our medical training in the doctoral program was about how do we support people who are dying? Because when people come see us, we're in palliative care. And so we have to figure out like what this looks like for us. And then I think that training really helped me understand that, oh, in my profession, I'm not here to save anyone. Like, and if somebody dies, this is not like a failure on my part as a medical professional. And it, you know, and it's like, I don't know if other schools get that training, but I was so grateful to have that really drilled into our head that like in so many other ways, not even just about death and dying, but just like when your patient comes into your clinic room, like that power dynamic, you're not some savior, you know, this is a very collaborative relationship that you're going to build. And then from that get-go, I think when you have that perception, when you begin that relationship with your patient, it really changes the dynamic of what this relationship is going to look like or what this journey is going to look like, even if they're coming in for like allergies or back pain.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Thank you for saying that too. It's so true. And that's exactly it. I think it's interesting, even personality wise, the way in which that we, you know, view life, the way we view death. And we just need all these components, I think, to have well-rounded care, you know?
Yeah. I have a question for both of you, actually. I'm so curious to know, like, how does your culture, what does death culture look like in both of your cultures?
That's such a good question, Damson.
I'm thinking about all the funerals that I've been to from different cultures. So yeah, I want to know.
Right. So I'm multiracial. I'm biracial, Magda. And so my father, who's Caucasian, my mother's Chinese, and her grandparents were very Buddhist. And I feel, and their siblings. And those are the very first services that I attended as a very young child were Buddhist services. And I just remember there was a lot of like incense offerings. Like these are just kind of like things like photographic memories that I'm picking out. People dressing in white instead of black, because that's kind of the absence of life. And then there would always be like a really big food event afterward. And it kind of felt like a party. And it would be like a Chinese banquet. And that's the part that I would have fun at, because like all the younger kids, you would just run around and have fun. And that just felt, I don't know, it was like almost like a family event, gathering, reunion. It didn't have this like really dark, heavy overtone, because I think there was that understanding that they were going to come back, reincarnate, and then learn those lessons in their next lifetime that they didn't in this lifetime. My dad's side, his family have all thankfully passed away of old age. And so they were all in 95 and older, between 95 and 105. So I went to like my great, great's funeral, whose father was in Gettysburg, like just really wild stuff like that. And that also felt so different, because it felt like it was peaceful. They passed of old age, they passed in their sleep. They made the decision at 103 that they were too tired to eat and drink anymore. And so we just let that process happen. So I feel like I was blessed to not have too much, you know, I did lose a couple aunties prematurely, and that was pretty devastating for the family because of the circumstances. But anyway, that's kind of the overview of what it was for me.
So was your dad's family religious? Like, was it a typical like American, like were people crying, or did you have a wake afterwards?
Yeah, I think because the thing is like, because these people passed away so old,
yeah,
they didn't have friends. They didn't have contemporaries. So it was just like, we, you know, the next, like my dad would be their grandchildren, And so because of that, I think that there's just a distance of like things weren't so, memories weren't so fresh and memories weren't right. so, yeah. So that part of it also, I think, didn't make it as intense. Yeah.
What does death culture look like, or rituals or anything look like in your culture, Magda?
I think the first funeral I went to was with my Lao family. I'm trying to think if I've even attended a funeral before that. And it was with my uncle that was my age nearly. And I was younger, and it was so interesting. Like it impacted me for the rest of my life, because it was essentially the biggest celebration of life. I mean, what you think of with traditional Western funerals, I did not experience. Like, we wore white. There's so much ritual around everything. There's so much happening. There's chanting. And then after all of that, there's so much grieving, right? There's so much grieving in the process and the rituals. And it just turns into the biggest celebration of life. Like, I will never forget that night, the way in which that I'm, you know, taking shots with my family and drinking and eating all this amazing food, and it's crying and it's laughing, and it's really about life, you know, and like loving the person that we lost and honoring that person. And it's for us as the living to really just continue to appreciate this life and rejoice and be so present in what is. And I think that was one of the most beautiful experiences in tragedy that I've had, because of those contrasts, you know. And then I've been to other funerals that are more traditional. And it's interesting because I talk a lot about this with grief, where, you know, we're talking about these systems that we're in and the ways in which that we kind of move with the end of life. Where I've been to funerals where I felt like it is the most inappropriate thing for me to do is cry, you know, and I think that's really interesting.
Yeah. Talk more about that.
I think because the funeral itself and like the energy around it was very stoic, it's very serious, it's very, you know, you attend, you wear the black, you stay, and like, because it wasn't a family member, it's like there's almost hierarchy in grief, you know, and like it's really interesting. And I've had those experiences, and where I felt like it would be inappropriate if I'm crying over this person that I'm not related to. Yeah, so there's a lot of contrast, and there's a lot of different funerals I've been to. My partner, it's like I'm going to this beautiful choir church, you know, with all of these people singing and crying, and there's so many funerals in which that, like, there's, I don't know, it's just different. I think it's just different depending on your cultural background and who the person is that you're celebrating. I've been to one in which that our friends, they want to do a celebration of life, and I guess he really loved football, so turned into kind of like a tailgate party, you know, like that's just
I love it.
Like, there's just so many variations. And I think, like, yeah, I think that's what's kind of cool, is like the more that we can keep talking about this, so we can really honor the person, what they want. And I think that's something that is hard for us as the living, or the ones that aren't dying, is like we treat it as if it's our dying, our death, our funeral. But it's like, what does that person want? You know, like, what would they really want? And that's what was so cool about the friend, is like, you know, her father loved the Seahawks, loved, you know, football. So it literally was like a tailgate party, and it was very interesting.
I'm obsessed now. Like, I want to like Google all like death rituals, like how funerals happen in other cultures. And like, I don't know why I didn't think about this, because I've gone to, like, it's so interesting that when like we celebrate weddings, like, so big, right? But when we think about funerals, we don't like put that same we don't know much about it. And so there's all different types of weddings, so why shouldn't there be all? And a lot of wedding is very cultural based too. And I know, like, some of my, I hate weddings, like, please don't invite me to your wedding, like, I don't want to go. But the best weddings that I've gone to were ones that come from their culture. And those I've always loved, because it's like, I've never seen anything like this before. And that to me seems like, and when you get to weddings outside of Western culture, it is truly like a family celebration. And I think of funerals, it must be like that too, right? Like, it's just so whatever, like it could be a tailgate party, it could be this, that, and it's, yeah, it's so beautiful actually.
Mm-hmm. So Magda, you know, you work with death so intimately, and you shared that right now with the pandemic, it's predominantly with family members of those who are dying. So I have a couple questions. One is, do you have, through your experiences, do you have a strong sense of what is on the other side? And two, if you do, how has that really influenced the way in which you choose to live your life on a day-to-day basis and what you kind of see for yourself? Yeah.
Tell us what happens after death.
Yes, juicy question. And I'll
give us
always,
the secrets.
But I'll always say that's for you to define. I'll always say that's for you to define. And it's so interesting because, listen, like, I've worked with a lot of people that have had near-death experiences, or people that have had loved ones that have had the near-death experiences, or their own experiences, or what I've experienced with dying, my mother's death, you know, everything. And there's a lot of similarities, you know, even across like spiritual traditions, and there's a lot of similarities and belief systems. And with all of this information, I will remain neutral. Like, I feel like I have my beliefs, right? Mm-hmm. But I'm always trying to remain neutral, because I really want to encourage everyone else to define that for themselves and to be open. I feel like just across the board with the same amount of information, the similar thing is, across the board, there's a big white light. There's a big white light. And a lot of folks that I've worked with too, like, that's what they've seen, that's what they've experienced. And one of my favorite, I forget who said this, but I really loved it, because we have a lot of beliefs when it comes to the end of life. Is they were like, what's going to happen to you is what you believe. And I thought that was interesting. So it's like, whatever you believe in this life is what you may experience. And I know Buddhism, I mean, all across religion and spirituality, we have very, very strong belief systems. And I think I know it's a buzzkill, but it's like, I love a mystery, you know? It's mm-hmm. like, I'm never really going to know until I like physically die.
Yeah. But I mean, like, wait, come back and tell us.
Okay, I will.
Like, leave signs.
I'll tap you on the shoulder. Yeah.
Okay, but what are some, I mean, I hear you. I hear like this mystery, this neutrality, and the importance of that, so that our consciousness mm-hmm. can really create our own afterlife. Mm-hmm. But what are your beliefs? I mean, there must be some, right? Like, what do you see and envision for yourself when you make the move over?
I think what I want to believe is that I know I will not know anything until that happens. And I want to believe that everything that I'm doing, it both matters and it doesn't. And inherently, it's all connected. And that after I die, I'm gonna, you know, my physical body dies, but there's still a spirit, there's still an essence, there's still energy, and that gets transported, that gets moved. And yeah, I believe that it'll go to another dimension. I mean, I've had the dreams with dead people, I've seen ghosts, you know, so it's like, I know that there's other worlds for me, like, that's the for sure, like, I know that. But yeah, I think that being so close to death, though, is it is my biggest kind of perspective and motivator on how to live life. And I think that's why I appreciate the end of life so much. Like, it strips away all the bullshit. It strips away all of the distractions. It strips away everything to what really matters. And, you know, I think because I am constantly having that in my awareness and permanence, death, that I continue to choose the actions that I know if I died the next moment, I'd be cool with it, you know, making sure I say love you every time I, you know, with family, friends, being aligned with what I really care about, being aligned with people that, you know, bring joy, bring these experiences with. Like, I think it has really aligned my life in a way that brings me peace, I think, with my own death.
Man, something was coming up when you were talking about like just living every moment, knowing that like that if you were to die, you're okay with it, right? Like, and I think that's such a powerful way to maybe work if you have fears around death. I can't like quite explain it, but it makes sense to me that like, and then also maybe be more present in your relationships and intentional in your life. If not that like I could go any minute now, so I better say I love you, you know, but really like work with that. Like this is actually something I want to do intentionally. I want to tell you that I love you. I want to tell you that I miss you. Not because I might die in an hour, but if it happens, I wanted to be at peace with that. What do you think about Paige in terms of like you? What do you think happens after death? Because Paige is like she's real spiritual. Like she sees things.
Yeah,
and stuff.
I mean we could go there. Yeah.
I mean, do you guys really want to know? I mean, yes. So I really feel, oh my gosh, I'm obsessed. I'm actually so obsessed with death. And I don't know if it's part of being a physician or a clinician and if it's just natural to be so curious and always like on the hunt to find out more information. But I really feel, I mean, I really resonated with a lot of what Magda said, because I feel like, I mean, everything is consciousness, right? And if you follow the Big Bang Theory, we were all one and then all separated. So technically, energetically, we still are all one. So I feel like everything is just a projection of our consciousness, like a holographic projection of our consciousness. And we agree that something is what it is. It's because all of that consciousness agrees on it and it begins to materialize. But when you break it down, it's still just floating atoms, right? And so I feel like what you believe in your afterlife will be your post-life space. So for example, like Catholics and Christians that really believe in heaven, it's definitely already been established because such a big population of consciousness believes in it. So it certainly exists in a very like solid form. And that is where they will go. And then for Buddhists, et cetera. So, but I also feel like I do believe in like the cycle of birth and death and rebirth, and also being free of that cycle once you've kind of lived out your karmic contract or what you're supposed to learn. And then after that, I feel like you become a traveler of the cosmos and you just are infinitely going between realms and dimensions and galaxies and you're free. And I also feel like a lot of us here right now in this dimension are just like fallen angels and we kind of have to like repent and like re-earn our way. We disturbed the peace in like the ethers. And so we were like, no, you can't disturb the peace. This is like the utopia. You have to go down. You have to do your little timeout on earth. And then you got to earn your way back up here. And you got to keep doing it until you cleansed and purified. And then you can finally come up and join us here on this dimension. Like, oh yeah,
this is what I love about this podcast. I mean, I love having guests, but the things I learn about Paige, it's like, it's mine. I love learning this stuff from her. And yeah, if that's the latter is true, man, that makes sense. That's why I'm stuck here right now trying to figure it out. And it reminds me of like when you were talking about it, I'm like, oh my God, this reminds me of like, it's like after death, it's like you just land at this airport and you take that train, you know, it's the terminal A, Christians and Catholics get off, and then terminal B, Buddhists.
But you know, one more thing I'll say is I think that some people are sent down to come and try to save you. So let's say you disturb the peace and you're sent down and you have a really strong connection to someone in the ethers. They may choose to come down and try to save you and kind of make an agreement. And sometimes if they can't save you, they'll be called back, or sometimes they'll sacrifice their own experience for you. So I definitely believe that that's true too.
I appreciate you sharing all of that, and I so feel you on so much of what you shared. And I remember one time just learning, I think something that kind of resonated with me, which was interesting, is and it all plays off of Buddhism, and it all plays off of like reincarnation and rebirth and all of these beliefs that we've had for so long, which was like, we have to learn, you know, we have to learn our lessons, our soul lessons, as many times as we need to until we get it. And then that essentially becomes like the freedom. Is it nirvana? Yeah. And then essentially you have like the nirvana. But yeah, there's a lot of similarities between all of it. And it's just like, I think I've gotten to a point in like my own spiritual practices where it's like, I'm like cool with just being so neutral and open. And I think it's really helpful to have these thoughts and reflect on these questions and reflect on your belief system, so you do have a greater purpose of caring, you know. And I think that's what's really difficult. And I always ask atheists and other folks that are just like very matter of facty, just like, oh, nope, yeah, I'm a human, I die. Like, I'm fascinated by them, yeah, because I'm just like, but what, like, what actually keeps you going? Like, what actually keeps you going if nothing matters? Like, that is, I love those personalities, because I love to just ask, like, what is it, you know? And sometimes we need these beliefs and stories, and sometimes we don't. But I think for me, it's really important to have a greater sense of like meaning.
What is our purpose? Have you asked? Like, can you, have you asked an atheist? No, an atheist. Oh, like,
yeah, it's the things that I've asked, and I hear the same things, is just, there's no purpose. Like, they just go into like, there's just no purpose. Like, we are born from these cells and then we die. And like, I mean, there's not, I go into like the emotional component though, where it's like, why do you care? Like, why do you even brush your teeth? You know, like, why do you actually care about anything?
Yeah.
You know, what is it? And yeah, I haven't really, I mean, I'll report when I hear something, but like, it's usually just very, just matter of fact, you're like, just because, like, I don't want to deal with, you know, teeth problems or something. So it's interesting. That's
really interesting. I'm reading this book by, I love this writer, Emily Nagoski. She wrote this really good sex book called Come As You Are. But I think before or after, she wrote a book about the stress cycle, like, it's about being burnt out. But what I love about her work is that she mixes like science, like spirituality, and like personal experiences. I mean, she's just a fantastic writer. And in Come As You Are, she talks a lot about, I'm going to get back to atheism. I know I'm going on a detour, but just come on along with me. She talks about how orgasm is so affected by stress cycle, right? And I think this is, and everyone kind of harped on that part of the book. And even though this book was a lot about like pleasure and desire and intimacy, and what does this all look like when we have sex, but people, the readers really loved this one little, and it's so funny because that's the chapter that I remember the most, because she really talks about like what's going on in your brain when you cannot achieve orgasm with your partner that you love or whatever. And so she wrote this book about being burnt out and stress cycle. And she talks about how we are constantly in this stressed out state, and we have to find ways to break this cycle, almost like everyday thing, like a maintenance thing, so it doesn't load up in our bodies. And that's where we get burnt out, is when all this stress accumulates and we haven't ended that cycle. And for people who have purpose in their life, they're able to do this a lot more easily. And that purpose could be, you could believe in a religion, you could have a spiritual practice, your purpose could be your children, whatever, but this deeper sense of like, life has a deeper purpose and meaning, and they're less likely to get burnt out because it's less about the work that you have to do and more about this bigger purpose.
Yeah, I've read that too in studies of just people like with recovery, you know, their recovery processes.
You're right.
And just, you know, the positive effects of belief systems, you know, whatever that may be, it's revealing in these research studies. So, you know, whatever that may be, even if you just want to believe in nature, you know, something greater, it's helpful for me anyways, you know?
Yeah. So then how, Magda, how do you take care of yourself? Because I'm imagining this work, and it's your work is so deeply enmeshed with, it sounds like, with your just your purpose, your whole being, like your everyday, right? I feel like you don't turn it on, turn it off, like check in, check out with work. How do you take care of yourself? Like, how do you nourish yourself?
I do a lot of things. I mean, I think it's mandatory if I want to continue doing anything that I'm doing. You know, this requires sensitivity. It requires, you know, care, and you have to be okay to provide that, right? So my practices are fluid. And I think what I try and do almost every day is some kind of movement. So yoga, going on walks, riding a bike, meditation is really big for me. And then what I like to do, whether it's weekly or when I can, a lot of writing, a lot of journaling, energy work is really big for me. Staying connected to friends, talking, you know.
Is this therapy. What led to your, yeah, therapy, yeah. Is this what led to you studying at the Zen Contemplative Care Center?
No, I actually, so I finished it. Okay, I wanted congrats. To note that. Thank you. What led me to doing it was I knew of another death doula that had completed the program, and they had a great experience doing so. And for me, I really appreciated Buddhist lens and end of life care merged together. And I hadn't seen any kind of program like that. So, yeah, it was just really great to have more of a contemplative approach to what I do. But yeah, self-care is really important. And I know that we want to stigmatize it as kind of, you know, a privilege, but it takes a few minutes, you know, just sitting with yourself is so impactful if you can do that, because I know myself and I know if I'm not doing those things, I can't show up as well. I can't be as loving. I can't be as open. So yeah, it affects everyone. It's just not yourself, how you're taking care of yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting because most of the homework that I prescribe to my patients is free. And I think a lot of times for self-care, and how it is marketed and how it's really fallen into this capitalist grind is we think that it has to be such a huge investment of time and resources. And, but we do lose sight of, oh, you mean I can just take a walk? I can just meditate. I can journal. I can get out in the sun. So it sounds like, I mean, of course you are always continuing your own education and that does take money. But I think that the things that you are doing on a day-to-day basis are pretty seamless. They're not a huge time commitment. They are things that are available to you at your tips at no extra cost. And so I think it's great for our listeners to be reminded of that too. But Magna, it was so awesome to talk to you and get to know you more. We always conclude our episodes by asking our guests what their beauty legacy is, what they want to leave behind when they make the transition.
Oh, what a glorious question. Let's see here. Yeah, I think that leaving just a positive impact behind, if it can be a little bit better than how it started for me, I think I'd be just fine with that.
I love that. It's so simple and beautiful. We're going to put all your information in our show notes and everything, but can you share with our listeners where they can find you, where they can connect you with you and learn more about your work?
Sure. I'm online on the internet. You can just go to my website, bacii.co, bossy.co. I'm on Instagram at bossy. And yeah, email me, reach out to me, DM me, and I hope to be connected to you.
Amanda has a really good newsletter, y'all. Like, I subscribe to it and I love it when it comes into my inbox and just like getting a chance to read your beautiful writing. So definitely subscribe to that newsletter.
Okay. Oh, and my newsletter, yes. Thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Oh my gosh, we could have just chat with you for like hours. I love this, learning more about your work. And I think it's just, you know, it to me, it looks like you really truly found your purpose, because your essence is so palpable, and it just, you can feel it, you know, and I imagine doing this sort of work can be very exhausting, but the essence that I feel from you is very light. It's very loving, and it's very inviting. So thank you for sharing your story with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right.
Bye everyone.
Well, that's it for today. If you like this episode, please give us a 5-star rating, subscribe, and share it with your friends. You can follow us on Instagram at @beautyasabirthright and say hello. If you're interested in learning more about Taoist face reading, head over to elementalarchetypes.com and follow Dr. Tamsin on Instagram at @elementalarchetypes. If you like to explore beauty through your own hands, you can visit yangface.com. You may also explore Paige's Instagram at yang.face for tutorials, Chinese medicine theory, and candid thoughts on cultural appreciation.